Welcome to the Magic and Alchemy Podcast, where we talk about witchcraft, setting intentions, forgotten folklore, and mythology. Created by Tamed Wild, Magic and Alchemy is a collection of stories, rituals, and articles crafted by a variety of creators and writers, including myself, Kate Ballou, and my co-host, Kristen Lisenby. Hello and welcome back to the Magic and Alchemy Podcast. I'm Kate Ballou.
And I'm Kristen Lisenby. Happy Mercury Day, Kate.
Happy Mercury Day. We're here. We did it.
We did. How are things?
Things are good. Dark days, deep autumn. I'm like, cannot wake up. But it's always good to see your face. And I'm just so beyond excited about the conversation that we have to share with our listeners today.
Yes, collaborating with the dead, books and the magic of the Catskill Mountains, and so much more to discuss. But before we dive in, as we are recording, you realize something auspicious about the publication date of this episode.
Yes, I wasn't sure, listeners, but Kristen magically took this forgotten thread in my brain and found out that November 30th, tomorrow, is the day of Hecate Trivia, the three-faced goddess of the crossroads. So, Kristen, do you want to share a little bit more about what you found out about this sacred day?
Yes, I would love to. And first, I should mention that Hecate has a few sacred days, one being the 29th of each and every month, another being sometime around August 13th, which we talked about in Season 1, Episode 5, Hecate's Garden. There is also November 16th, Hecate's Night, where once night falls, Hecate is said to roam the earth with her hellhounds in a wild hunt-like affair. And tomorrow, on November 30th, we celebrate this goddess again, but specifically for her role as Queen of the Crossroads. November 30th is called Hecate Trivia, trivia being the Latin phrase for a three-way crossroads. From the book, Hecate Liminal Rites, a historical study of the rituals, spells, and magic of the torch-bearing triple goddess of the crossroads by Sarita D'Este and David Rankine, it explains that, quote, as well as being trimorphous, three-formed or three-bodied, she was also Triaditus, of the three ways or of the crossroads, a title which was also Latinized into Trivia. In this role, Hecate was the dreadful queen of the dead, attending the crossroads with her ghosts and demons. In the Roman period, when she was syncretized with Diana, that goddess also used the title and was called Diana Trivia. End quote.
Popular offerings for Hecate are often eggs, honey, cake, or garlic. For anyone looking to celebrate either tonight on the 29th or tomorrow on the 30th or yet again on the 29th of next month. And these offerings can be left at crossroads near or in your home. Think windowsills, doorways, where three paths meet, be it in the woods or on the road, whatever resonates with you. And all of these thoughts, Kristen, just make so much sense to me for this time of the year. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, this season is definitely a crossroads where the shadows stretch and the darkness and mysteries are just ever so present. This time between Samhain and Solstice definitely is the time of the goddess.
Absolutely. So happy Hecate Trivia to you, Kate, and to anyone celebrating. And would you like to introduce our guest for today?
Yes, a truly liminal being herself. I would be so honored. Perdita Finn is the co-founder with her husband, Clark Strand, of the Feral Fellowship, The Way of the Rose, which inspired their book, The Way of the Rose, The Radical Path of the Divine Feminine, Hidden in the Rosary. They are currently at work on their next book together, Circles Not Lines, Spiritual Community Beyond Patriarchy. To find out more about her devotion to ecology, not theology, you can visit thewayoftherose.org. In addition to extensive study with Zen masters, priests, spirit workers, and healers, she apprenticed with the psychic Susan Saxman, with whom she wrote The Reluctant Psychic. Perdita Finn now teaches popular workshops in getting to know the dead. Participants are empowered to activate the miracles in their own lives with the help of their ancestors and recover their own intuitive magic. Her book, Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World, is an intimate journey through her recovery of these lost ways. She speaks widely on how to collaborate with those on the other side, on the urgent necessity of new romantic animism, and the sobriety that emerges when we claim the long story of our souls. Her next book is The Body of My Mother. She lives with her family in the moss-filled shadows of the Catskill Mountains.
In this conversation, we wind our way through tales of the dead, connecting and honoring the unseen, complex histories, the importance of moss, writing a book in collaboration with the dead, spirituality practices, trusting our intuition, and the mothers and the grandmothers.
Perdita joined us from these very moss-filled shadows via Zoom. Hello, and welcome back to the Magic and Alchemy podcast. I'm Kate Ballou.
And I'm Kristen Lisenby. And today we have Perdita Finn here with us. Welcome to the podcast, Perdita. How are you today?
Oh, I'm terrific because I'm so happy to be here talking with you both. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's so nice to meet you and gather with you in this liminal time between fall and winter. Uh-huh. So for our listeners who are just meeting you today for the very first time, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work and what it means to be in conversation with the unseen?
Well, you know, my work is all about the liminal and the in-between. And it's all about how to see with the eyes of the dead and how that can really help us feel more alive. And all my work is really about the revelation I've had over many decades that the dead are right here with us. And I call them the dead, not my ancestors or my lineage, because I'm not just talking about my biological relatives. I'm talking about every soul on the other side. I'm talking about the animate everything, is what my daughter Sophie Strand calls it. You know, every soul that has ever been. And that they want to collaborate with us. And so those collaborations have become my work and my experience with them, which I write about in great detail. You know, it began, you know, I had been doing this work for decades when I very privately, very personally, somewhat secretly, because I said, couldn't explain it. You know, it didn't have a tradition. It didn't have any form or rules. It was just something. The dead were my teachers. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really explain all the wonders that were unfolding. And then 13 years ago, I met this, as I talk about in my book, I met this extraordinary psychic. I mean, she's really like a little fairy oracle. You know, she's a woman who had to teach herself to tell the difference between the living and the dead as a child, who still sometimes has a hard time telling the difference. And what she confirmed to me was that all the experiences I'd been having were very real, and also that everyone was psychic. And this was kind of that great, oh, that's what's been going on in my life. And so the last 13 years have been a kind of reclamation of what I've always known, a reclamation of my intuition and imagination. And the writing and teaching I do is to help empower people to settle themselves in their own intuition and imagination, in their own potential for magic.
In a recent article on your Substack, you write that I am not frightened of the dead. That is what it means to be a witch. And I would love to hear about your relationship to this word, witch, and witchcraft, and how it's evolved over time with your and through your work with the dead.
This is a whole other book I'm working on.
Can't wait.
The whole series is up for free on my Substack, so read it while it's still there. But let me talk about why I'm not frightened of the dead, because many of us are. I certainly was for a long time. And the reason so many of us are frightened of the dead is because we've been conditioned to be frightened of the dead. Our entire culture is a propaganda campaign against the conversation with the dead. A number of feminist scholars, Max Dashu and Anne Barstow particularly, have documented how explicitly the priests and religious authorities had to silence the conversation between ordinary people and the dead in order to get them to pay attention to them. Why should they listen to some abstract God on high when they were in conversation with their grandmothers and their ancestors? Well, thus began the propaganda campaign. And it culminates on the edge of the Enlightenment. You know, we think of the Enlightenment as this great moment of progress and, you know, liberalism and greatness. And what it really is the final silencing of our conversation with the dead, which is also simultaneously our conversation with the unseen world and the whole of nature. And that silencing happens in Europe by both Protestants and Catholics in what we call the witch craze. I don't think we have any awareness of the kind of endless explosion of violence that occurred for 200 years. And it didn't happen in the Middle Ages. It didn't happen in the Renaissance. It happened between the 1500s and to the middle 1700s. And it didn't happen in uneducated communities. It didn't happen much in Ireland or Portugal. It happened in Germany and Scotland and England. It happened in the most educated and scholarly places in Europe. And it was an outgrowth of that rationalism. And so that's one of the things that's really, and it's always interesting to me to note that, you know, we think a lot of times, you know, that great, another piece of propaganda is The Crucible by Arthur Miller. And he has a lot of amends to make because he makes it, you know, it seem as though it's a bunch of hysterical teenage girls, you know, those hysterical teenage girls who get everybody killed. And that's not what happened. A group of intellectuals from Harvard came and set up courts and trials and hung men and women for being witches. And that's the best and the brightest doing what they do best. And that wasn't the only witch trial in America. And those weren't the only witch deaths in America. There were many. And in Europe, there were places in Germany where after the inquisitors came through that not a single woman was left alive. Not a young woman, not an old woman, not a middle-aged one. Not a single woman was left alive. Now, Barstow, who's really the most interesting scholar about this period, she documents that the single thing that women were most often accused of doing wasn't herbalism, wasn't midwifery. It was speaking to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
It was that conversation with the dead that empowers us, guides us, makes us not listen so much to the religious man. And that conversation with the dead was silenced and suppressed. If you kill every woman in a village, women for hundreds of miles around, women for 100 years after are going to be terrified of that conversation. And then, of course, we have the modern iteration of the witch trials, which becomes the psychiatric establishment accusing women of being hysterical, you know, crazy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is not to say that our culture doesn't breed tremendous mental illness and mental suffering, but so much of what was once a wholesome, loving conversation was silenced. And also, I always say the dead are the best anxiety medicine there is. You know, you don't need Prozac if you feel held and loved by legions of grandmothers and ancestral mothers. And so I'm not scared of the dead, not any of them. I'm not scared of dead Hitler because he's dead. But I'm scared of the living Hitlers. I'm scared of reasonable men in boardrooms right now as we have this conversation figuring out where to drop their next bombs. I'm terrified of what the living do to each other each and every day. And they commit these acts of and atrocities because they're not in conversation with the dead, because they do not see with the eyes of the dead. If they could see with the eyes of the dead, they would know that the children they are bombing, the people upon whom they are enacting these atrocities, have been their mothers in past lives, have been their children in past lives, are their kin. And it is only because of that silenced conversation that we can behave with the violence that we do. That's why I call myself a witch.
And what do you think is a common misconception about the dead or the spirit world? I know you talk about several in your book.
Well, we've been so conditioned to be frightened of them, right? From the time we're children, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, we put children in rooms by themselves and they naturally get terrified because little baby animals are not meant to sleep by themselves, right? Little baby animals are meant to sleep with grown-up animals that protect them and keep them safe. And then they cry because they're alone in the dark. And then we tell them to cry it out and learn that no help is coming, right? Mm-hmm. So our entire culture is constructed about reifying these fears from the moment we're born. But in fact, children often sense the dead close. They often have imaginary friends. They often feel them coming close. But what if we could empower them to know that these are resources and friends? People often come to me and they're scared of the dead. They're going to hurt me. They're going to jinx me. They're going to hex me. They're going to haunt me. Well, the dead have to work very hard to get our attention in this culture. And sometimes the way they get our attention can be terrifying. So I tell a story about my son when he was in college and he was having this, you know, Mr. Science moment in college. And, you know, in my crazy mother, oh, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. And I'm like telling him, you know, please set up your ancestor altar. And, you know, he's really, and which he does, by the way, anyway, but he still is like dismissing me and mad at me a lot. He's home alone one summer in the house. It's a summer day. The windows are all shut. You know, it's a quiet day. Air conditioning's on. And he's making himself a sandwich in the kitchen. And my ancestor altar, which you can see behind me, abuts the kitchen. And it's like an ancestor wall. He's just quiet day. He's making a sandwich. And out of the blue, for no apparent reason, every photograph falls off the ancestor altar. And not one of them breaks. He is so terrified when I get home. He's like covered in goosebumps. He's shaking. And he said, what does it mean? I said, they just want you to know they're real and they're there.
And that'll get your attention.
They got his attention. Now he takes me for walks in graveyard and we pick up names and we talk to them. It's all fun. But, you know, here's the thing. I worked with a woman in one of my classes and she'd been haunted her whole life by the ghost of her father who had committed suicide in her presence when she was 4 years old. And this was a horrific experience and such an aggressive, violent, hostile thing to do to a child, right? And he began appearing in her bedroom. When I met her, she was 70 years old and he'd been appearing in her room the whole life, haunting her the whole life. Then she'd become a therapist and she had done all this shamanic work. She'd gone to Peru. How do I get rid of him? How do I get rid of him? I said, What do you want from him? Give him a job to do. And she did. And this is what I always tell people to do with the dead. Ask him for something impossible. Well, she asked him for something impossible, a job she really wanted. There was no chance she was going to get. And the next day she got it. And she showed up weeping. And she said, I realized he's been trying to apologize to me my whole life. I realized that the moment he died, he knew what he'd done. And he'd been trying to atone. And he wanted to come to me and work with me and show me that he loved me. And she's been collaborating with her father ever since.
So beautiful. And that was a part of your book that really, really stuck out to me too, about giving the dead a job, because I've also similarly been afraid of visitors, you know, especially as I was living alone before my relationship. I was kind of very unnerved by a lot that was going on. But the book too, reading it this week was so timely. I was telling Kristen before the call, like, I woke up at 3 a.m. to the smell of an older woman's perfume. And I would normally have been very unnerved because my houseplants rustled in like the office room, like next to the bedroom. And I thought that a leaf had dropped and it hadn't. And my dog sat up and I, you know, was assuming it was one of my grandmothers. I gave them a job that I'll keep private for now. But, and then I got a text message from my sister this morning about waking up having wanted to talk to one of these grandmothers in particular. And I was like, oh, it's her. And I was able, because of that sort of reframe, to have more of a loving conversation instead of, I'm awake now, it's 3 and I'm unnerved and I don't know what to do. Like, there's nowhere for that energy to go, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, we call 3 a.m. the hour of the wolf many times because, you know, it's the moment of terror and anxiety when we wake up. My husband wrote a whole book about it called Waking Up to the Dark, about the fertile womb of darkness at that moment. And you know, it's an extraordinary meditation on the Black Madonna and the lost experience of darkness. But also he says, you know, that's the hour of magic. Mm-hmm. We have made that magic time fearful. And what you did is exactly right. I mean, it can be disarming when the dead show up. I mean, I've had the dead show up. I think a lot of us do. And one of the things, I hold monthly conversations for people to just share these experiences, because everyone's having them, by the way. Mm-hmm. Everyone's having them. Even those men in boardrooms medicating themselves out of them, having them.
We talk about witchcraft and magic as being an exercise and a practice, an observation in noticing as like a first step to any of it.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, I don't have any recipe books. You know, I learned to do all this sort of with the guidance of the dead. And I think the dead will teach you everything you need to know. And there are no recipes. You can't do this wrong. They won't hurt you. They won't lead you astray. I trust them. You know, it's really, the thing is, you can't do this wrong if you're doing it. What's wrong and upsetting is our addiction to this ecocidal madness we call civilization. That is what gets us in trouble. And our experience of isolation, our desperate yearnings that go unacknowledged, our sense of being alone and having to be independent, these are the things that hurt us. Magic is the most natural thing in the world. It's organic. It's permaculture. You know, it's magic when the leaves change colors. It's magic when they fall. Howard Nemiroff, the poet, wrote this beautiful poem once about that moment being there for when all the ginkgo leaves fell off a ginkgo tree, the same moment. Mm. Like, what do we think magic is? We think it's some technicolor industrial calamity, and it's that, it's being present for that. And your grandmother showing up and bringing wonders and love into your life. Love is magic. And ultimately, that's what it's about. The dead love us. All the dead love. And knowing that and experiencing it is the greatest magic of all. And when we kind of unite forces with what I call that kind of erotic animism of all that is, everything becomes possible.
And before we jump over to your book, which we've mentioned a few times already, and I'm really excited to talk about, I want to just go back to that same Substack article that Kate mentioned earlier, because in that article, you say, the whole earth is nothing but the body of the dead and an altar to our ancestors. And I think this is such a stunning sentiment. And Kate and I have talked before on this podcast about the garden as an altar and the body as an altar. And I'm wondering if you could expand on the earth as an ancestor altar and how it shows up in your spiritual or creative practice or both.
Well, I suppose my whole book is a testament to that. So I'll try to summarize it. What I would ask listeners to do is to go outside. And wherever you are in a city or the country, I don't care, you know, a little suburban square, scrape up some dirt in your fingertips or in your hand. That dirt is nothing but the bodies of the dead. It's the bodies of insects that have vanished from the world, feathers, animals, plants that have been born and died and become dirt. It's the bodies of stones that were once sea creatures 350 million years ago. When you hold dirt in your hand, what we're holding are the bodies of the dead out of which everything on this planet has grown. Everything grows from dirt. Everything grows in the dead. Life comes from the bodies of the dead. And it leads us back into an experience of what I call the ecological equation. And this is an equation that modern human beings are trying to deny and to defy. And that is whatever eats is eaten. Our bodies will become the bodies out of the dead, out of which new life will grow. This is a guarantee. Everything we eat will go into our body to help it grow. And one day our bodies will go into other beings to help them grow. This is literally expounded in the Chautauqua tales. These are the folk stories about the Buddha and incarnations before he became the Buddha. And they're really older animistic folk stories. And in them, he is a rabbit who sees a hungry traveler and jumps into the fire to feed the traveler. I think my own deep intuition is that our Paleolithic ancestors knew that every being they ate was their ancestor, literally their ancestors. They knew when they called themselves the salmon people or the reindeer people or the mammoth people, that wasn't just like a totemic affiliation. They knew that they ate salmon and then they would become the salmon that fed their people in their next lives. When you ate a salmon, you were eating your grandmother. There's an extraordinary story by an anthropologist who did not understand the story. It was a 1950s anthropologist who was completely clueless. But she's interviewing this Kong hunter gatherer in, you know, Southern Africa. And he's eating this elephant they've caught and killed. And she's been with him. And as he eats it, a moment of surprise comes. And he says, oh, the elephant tastes like my wife. The elephant is my wife. And he starts to weep. And his wife had died many years earlier. And he knows in this moment that he's eating. His wife has come back as the elephant to feed him and her children. And, you know, she has all these highfalutin ideas about what this moment is about. She cannot accept the lived, literal reality that we all come back to feed each other. What would we do when we sit down to eat if we knew we were eating the bodies of our ancestors who loved us so much and gave of their bodies so generously to us? You know, the very misunderstood magician Jesus You know, he says at one point, take, eat, this is my body. But this isn't a singularity. This is, he's trying to explain what the entire natural world is doing. So we are all, this is a long answer to your question of saying the whole earth is an altar. Our bodies are an altar. We stand atop the bodies of the dead. Our DNA builds us out of the bodies of the dead. We are, you know, I always love these techno-narcissist guys who think like we're going to go off and like live on Mars, right? And they can't even imagine the gut biome. What's going to happen to the gut biome on Mars? They're so smart. They can't figure that out. News for your buddy. Not going to work. We are the body of this planet. And this planet's body is our body.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful. I would love to shift us to talk to your about your book now, Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World. And this book is a memoir and was written in collaboration with your late father. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Yeah, my father was an atheist, an angry atheist, an angry modern 1950s atheist, rebelling against his immigrant Irish Catholic, you know, experience. And yet he was a deeply, he's a great lover of nature. I don't think he had any experience. His hatred of religion and was an important part of my childhood. It was a protective part of my childhood, but he didn't know what was in its place. And you know, he lived his life caught inside patriarchy. I always say patriarchy doesn't even work for the patriarchs. And it certainly didn't work for him. And, you know, after he died, after a very complicated relationship with him, he disinherited me from his will. And not that I wanted any money from him, but you want a testament of love and care and attention. And his will most certainly did not offer that. In addition, I received a very surprising gift from him from beyond the grave, which was, you know, not giving it away. It was a black rock wrapped in iron that he had sent to me after he died. And I document my conversations and experiences with him, healing with him from beyond the grave. And so it becomes a way of working out my own patriarchal indoctrinations. You know, when I went to study religion, because of course I was fascinated by it, I was having all kinds of mystical experiences like we all do. And I didn't know what box to put them in. So, you know, of course I went to try Catholicism because, like, you know, that was what my father rebelled against. You know, as I write in the book, I had an abortion the day after I was baptized in the Catholic Church. That didn't work out very well. And, you know, I always say it was a protective experience. But then I went to Zen Buddhism, which was an even more patriarchal experience. And so I think that freeing and liberating myself from these patriarchal indoctrinations and also wanting to free my father from them, and that conversation we had after he died becomes what the book is about. And what does it mean to, I suppose it is basic, and I don't think I've ever said this explicitly, I wish I could have offered to both my parents an awareness of what they really wanted, which was they were both radically devoted to the natural world. Like, their love of nature was a real gift. They were gardeners. They were berserk animal lovers. I mean, berserk animal lovers. Like, my father was a surgeon in a small town hospital, and he would operate on our family pets in the operating room at the hospital. And I mean, we had Boa constrictors and cats, and I mean, it was just nutty. And they didn't understand that was their mystical experience. And they didn't know how to claim it. So I suppose I wanted to write it for them. And I wanted to write it not just for them, but for my parents in my next life. Because I do believe in what I call the long story of our souls. And I actively pray every day to be reborn to parents who can help me claim that long story before I'm 50 years old this time and from the get-go. I think we would live very different lives if our parents knew how to recognize who we'd been and what gifts and prayers we were bringing in from past lives. So I wrote this book for my parents on the other side and for my parents on this side to come.
And this story within these pages is broken up beautifully with some of your poetry and answers to what I assume are some of the most common questions you get asked. And I highlighted one in particular because it shows up in our listener questions as well. And I thought we could talk about it, if that's okay with you.
Love to.
So from your chapter, Communicating with the Dead, when discussing the dreams, messages, and intuitive hits we receive, you write, "Couldn't I just be making this all up? Isn't it all in my imagination?" And I know we all have a special relationship with doubt and imposter syndrome. So what would you say to any listeners struggling to trust their intuition and who might be asking themselves the same thing?
Oh, that's such a big question. My husband and I were actually just talking about it yesterday morning. There is an idea from Buddhism I find helpful. And I mean, I think every religion holds ideas that are useful and helpful. We just need to get rid of the money-making and the sex scandals and the priests and the priests of the buildings, the whole hoopla. But some of the ideas are good. And one of them in Buddhism is the idea that great faith needs to be balanced by great doubt. And great faith and great doubt together hold a tension that helps us get our feet on the ground. And so as we step into this work, it's hard to trust our intuition. It's really hard to get people to trust their intuition. We trust our head, we trust our indoctrination, our culture, but we don't trust our guts very often. And the hardest thing is to trust that still small voice within us that knows, right? But one of the things that we can do with our doubts and our uncertainties about all this is to be in conversation with friends. Friendship shifts the culture of belief. And so this is why I hold monthly discussions or open conversations. I call them monthly magic. I hold them through my Substack community. And they're open conversations. Bring your conversation experiences with the unseen world and let's talk about them. And someone brings up like, is this wild to think that such and such? And everyone say, well, chime in and say, I had the same experience. Right? And it's imagination. You know, the psychic I wrote a book with, Susan Saxman, she's a wonderful being. And she always said, yeah, the good novelists are just channelers. They're just psychics, right? Imagination is psychism, right? I was talking to somebody who was reading Wolf Hall, that book by Hilary Mantel. You know, she just passed. She's an English novelist. It's a wonderful piece of historical fiction. And they said, you know, the secret, of course, is Hilary Mantel was Thomas Cromwell. That's why she wrote the book. And we forget that. You know what I mean? Like, everyone has their obsessions. Everyone has their interests. And our imagination is our psychism. I've learned to trust that. I didn't trust it for years. And I was a child. I terrified myself because I would have daydreams that came true. And I found it, I have a lot of precognitive daydreams. And I found this very terrifying as a child. And I thought, you know, I didn't know if it meant I was controlling the future. I didn't want to speak about it to anyone. I wanted to be a normal person. The specter of mental illness hung over my family because my grandmother, I won't even go into the horrors she experienced for being a woman who was unhappy for entirely appropriate reasons. But that specter hung over. So the last thing you wanted to do was to manifest any signs of instability. So I, of course, got into the family religion, which was psychoanalysis. And I tell the story in my book. I got into it because I was having so many apocalyptic visions. And this was the 1980s. And, you know, I channeled my fears into a lot of activism with the freeze movement and the anti-nuclear movement. But I was haunted by these experiences and these daydreams and these, and as I write in my book, you know, none of these therapists, I went to two different psychoanalysts who could, they could confirm they were happening. They couldn't tell me what to do with them. I needed an old grandmother. I needed a Baba Yaga. I needed, you know, and what I had to learn myself was that, what are these visions for? Why am I being given these visions? What do I do with them? So for instance, I had had, one of them was that I had seen a nuclear missile going over a city. This actually was not in my book. I took it out. And I saw human beings inside the missile. And even though this nuclear missile was about to detonate, it was filled with people in what in the dream I knew was the state of grace. And it was this contradiction between this object of horrific violence and these people in a state of grace. And I, in the dream, I'm inside the missile with them, and they come up to me and they crowd close to me and they teach me a mantra, which was for me, so I will hold on to it. And I woke up from this dream and I said to my husband, what do I do? And he's a good friend. And he said, say the mantra. What to do? I have 30 years, 5 years later, I'm still saying it all the time. But one day in September, about 8 years after this dream, I write down all my dreams. I was up working on my computer, and it's the old AOL dial-up days. And of course, I see a little screen come up, and it shows about a plane about to go through the Twin Towers. And I run downstairs and we turn on the television. And I say, oh, it wasn't a missile. It was an airplane filled with people. That's what I was seeing. And so I ran outside to the pond where we live in our backyard. And I just cried for them. And so I said this mantra for them over and over again. And as I was saying it, I looked up and there in front of me was a milkweed pod. And hanging from the milkweed pod was a monarch chrysalis. And as I said the mantra over and over again, a monarch emerged from the chrysalis and spread its wings. I don't know what it means. What solace does it offer to the families of the people who died? Nothing. But it was a confirmation for me that the dead need our attention. And they want to work with us and guide us.
And so many animal messages, I feel like they're everywhere. Like I'm thinking in particular about a rabbit and a Luna moth in my own life and red-tailed hawks or turkey vultures, and just seeing them, it offers just so much. I don't know.
Well,
know.
Kate, what I say is I often recommend my students work with an oracle. A tarot, be it tarot, the I Ching, the runes, I don't care what oracle it is, find one that works for you. But every oracle has its genesis in the natural world. So the runes take us back to the trees. The I Ching takes us back to the yarrow stalk, right? The tarot takes us back to the lived reality of the natural world. The world is an oracle deck. The whole world is in conversation with us. And the plants and the animals and the fungi, that conversation with the unseen world is seamless for them. And they're all trying to reinitiate us back into it. We are the species that has separated ourselves out. How can we re-enter that conversation?
Are you a word witch? It's Kate here, and if you're a book lover, a spellcaster of language, or a lover of the written word, Tamed Wild's digital subscription on Instagram has a book coven, and we're excited to invite you to join the circle. Each month, Danielle leads book discussions and the Tamed Wild team shares reels about plant magic, astrology, and tarot. This digital subscription is a coven for the solo practitioner looking to join in with like-minded, earth-spirited souls through the portal of Instagram. To learn more, visit @tamedwild on Instagram and subscribe while on mobile. Okay, now back to the show. I would love to talk a little bit about the land and the mountains where you live. In your book, in the chapter The Land of the Dead, you talk about leaving the city and moving to the Catskills, where you encounter beautiful mysteries, the dead, the unseen. And a lot of our listeners know I currently live in Brooklyn and spend a lot of time in the Catskills and can attest to their supernatural beauty and the spirits that live there. And I've had some amazing experiences there. But can you describe the Catskills a little for the listeners who may not be familiar with the area?
Sure. The Catskill Mountains were about 2 hours north of New York, but most people know about them from Rip Van Winkle. You know, a man goes into those mountains and disappears for 100 years and comes back, right? And the whole world has changed. And that experience is an experience a lot of people have in these mountains. In fact, a friend of mine wrote a wonderful modern update of Rip Van Winkle called Seven Locks, set in the modern Catskills. But yeah, and so these mountains aren't even typically mountains. You know, they're not made by the conjunction of tectonic plates. They were made by a river delta gradually wearing away the land so that and the land rising up. So they're very old and very, you know, and there are a lot of old stories about, you know, ancient asteroid impacts here. For whatever reason, because they were a river delta, they're very, very rocky. It's all bluestone. Much of the bluestone in Brooklyn, where you live, comes from the Catskills. They were mined extensively. But they were not a very good place for growing anything. They're very shady and they're very rocky. And in fact, the indigenous people didn't much live here. They came here for two reasons. One is to hunt, and one was for ceremonial purposes, as if they kind of could feel the tremendous power of this place. They're very moss covered. These days they're oak and maple and hemlock. You know, they were vastly denuded, of course, during the 19th century. And once upon a time, there were chestnut forests and many more hemlocks and ash trees and very different than they are today. But there is something, one of the things that's so interesting about them, where exactly where my husband and I live. You know, we live in this falling down little, I call it our little Baba Yaga cottage that we're kind of composting into moss. And we fought against the advice of everyone. But it was only about 10 years ago that we discovered a local hiker and an archaeologist discovered that there are cairns on the side of the mountain where we live that are definitely 5,000 years old. And maybe as old as 13,000 years. And they mirror the constellation Draco in the sky. And they lead Draco the dragon. And they lead to the side of the mountain to these great dragon formations on the side of the mountain. And I'm telling you, when I first went to see them with him, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to try to use my imagination to see the dragon. No, the dragons are easy to see.
Wow.
And they're fabulous. And they're really, you know, Kate, if you want to come up, I will take you to them.
I do. I 100% do.
We'll go play with the dragons. Okay.
Dream come true.
I live on that property. The little Baba Yaga, my husband and I walked onto this property. You know, we've been shown great houses and all the things we should do. And no, we want the little rundown shack, you know, because it was the land. And this land has been really sacred and holy for us and magical for us. It's also in a wetland, so which just explains the moss and the mold and all of it. But we have so many animals, and it's really alive. It turns out it's good to have a house covered in moss. I just read Robin Wall Kimmerer's book on moss.
I was just going to say, I feel like everyone should live where there is moss.
I love moss. Moss is one of my, you know, moss can't be domesticated. I love that about it. Mm. You can't make it grow.
What?
Robin Wall Kimmerer would get hired by this wealthy guy to try and grow him a moss garden. And she explains to him that it's impossible because moss grows where it wants to grow.
That's amazing.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
Half of Kristen and I's group chat is moss, just moss and nettles back and
moss
forth.
Moss pictures. Yeah.
Oh, really? Moss and nettles are like, yeah, I think I've got nettle tea right here.
Which necessities?
Exactly.
And do you know what exactly drew you to these mountains? In your book, your husband, Clark, describes the area and Woodstock specifically as a gateway, a portal, and an entry point. And I've never been, but it all just sounds so magical just hearing about it.
We're all drawn. We're all exactly where we're supposed to be. And we've all been drawn by the dead to where we are and where we belong. You know, I often ask people to think about where they were born. Why were you born there? I mean, we look at it, we use astrology to think about what, you know, why were we born under these star signs, but we forget to look at the ground where we're born. Why were you born to these dead, to this earth? You know, my husband, who's devoted to Our Lady of Guadalupe, really devoted to her, was coincidentally born in Mexico, Missouri. I, who had become a devotee of, I don't like to call it Mary, but, you know, old experiences of the mother, was, I grew up in Marion. You know what I mean? Like, I was also born in a hospital called Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge that abuts one of the biggest cemeteries in New England. I was born inside a cemetery. I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up. Where were you born? Why were you born there? Where are you now? How have the dead called each and every one of us to the magic that we need? Because sometimes we're called to places for a short time to collect magic. And sometimes we're called for a long time to collect magic, right? Like there, like everywhere we go, there's magic. We're all on pilgrimage. Our souls are on pilgrimage. And we used to be bodies on pilgrimage. When we were hunters and gatherers, we were always walking across the land, singing the ancestral songlines, right? And we were always in conversation with our ancestors. Every stone would have a story, an ancestral story attached to it. And so if a baby was born in a place, we would know the ancient stories it was being born into. And if someone died in a place, we knew which dead were receiving it, that person back into their arms. We're all on pilgrimage. Because we've become sedentary, we have forgotten pilgrimage and the power of pilgrimage and reclaiming pilgrimage. I mean, Woodstock is, for me, is a very magical place and for many people. But I would say that there is not a spot of land. It is not magical. It does not contain the bodies of the dead that you need.
My mind is like off on like a complete spiral now. I'm like, wow, I have so much to Google and write about after this conversation.
Good. I can't wait.
And I would just love to talk a little bit more about the mothers and the grandmothers. I know we've talked about them a little bit, but just to give them their own space, because I think one of my favorite lines in the book, it was in one of the letters to your father, and I just had to pause on it because it was, who might we be if we could reunite with our grandmothers and our mothers in the dark? And that brought tears to my eyes. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about this.
Well, that's the theme of all my work and writing, and my husband's work and writing, and my daughter's work and writing, and my son's work. He doesn't write much yet, but he is a gardener, a permaculture gardener. What does it mean to die? What do we remember? You know, in the long story of our souls, what is that long story? I like to sometimes imagine our souls as a thread. Imagine your soul as a colored embroidery thread. Pick a color, gold or blue or yellow or green, and imagine it woven in, back and forth through a cloth. But also know that there are thousands and millions of other threads simultaneously being sewn back and forth and entangled with that thread, right? And every stitch is a life. The thread is long, and some stitches are short, and some are short. And if we look at the embroidery from the backside, it looks like, you know, a frayed, knotted, jumbled mess. But when we see with the eyes of the dead, we can see the big picture. And what does it mean to see with that big picture of the long story? For me, it is to remember that we have, in lifetimes upon lifetimes, all been each other's mothers. And I don't mean that as like a metaphor. I mean that as a literal truth. And that if no one goes anywhere, if the first law of physics, the law of the conservation of matter and energy, is true, we've all always been here. We've all always been here. And we've all been entangled with each other, part of that matrix of creation from the get-go. And it will break our hearts to see with the eyes of the dead. A lot of people die. That father who killed himself in front of his daughter, what horror he must have felt when he saw with the eyes of the dead what he had done to his child, right? And I think a lot of us, when we see what we have done to our plant kin, our insect kin, our animal kin, our human kin, because we have forgotten that we're all each other's mothers, that we are all being eternally reborn to each other, we would be horrified to see what we've done to each other's children. What if the people, you know, what if the people dropping the bombs in Gaza could see that those children will be reborn as their children? You know what I mean? No one would drop anything. None. We would all be in reverence and heartbreak all the time if we knew this. But the other reality, and this is a book I'm really working on right now. It's called The Body of My Mother. I've written a lot on it in my paid Substack. Mothering is an impossible job. And it's been designed to be an impossible job in our culture on purpose. And it's been designed to be a failure. And if people feel denied adequate mothering, enough mothering, well, then they're more susceptible to capitalistic authority, right? And in during those 200-year period of the witch trials, mothers were encouraged to turn in their daughters to protect their lives. Daughters were encouraged to turn in their mothers to protect their lives. You know, the witch trials never ended, of course. They just came to the new world, and the violence and the sadism became enacted on the bodies of brown and black women. And white women were encouraged to turn in their black and brown sisters to protect their lives, right? So what's been done to motherhood is really vile. But I am fascinated by older experiences of motherhood. And one of the things that's so interesting to me is that many children in the few remnants of hunter-gatherer cultures we have experience themselves as not having one biological mother, but a circle of mothers and grandmothers. They experience, in fact, many women will often nurse a child. So not one woman's exhausted, depleted body is responsible for feeding a child. Many women will feed, including women who haven't had babies yet. Right? They can lactate, including postmenopausal women who can still lactate. Right? So, and that's fun. That's really fun. Even more fascinatingly, and I love this research, there's often a feeling that in all around the world that in hunter-gatherer cultures that women will experience themselves as always pregnant, but that the baby needs to be watered by a man in order to grow. Okay. But you might want to have him, the baby growing within you, watered by a lot of different men so that it gets a lot of different nutrients. It's mothered by a lot of different men. And so when the baby is born, many men experience themselves as the mother father of that child. In fact, semen is often called father milk, so that you experience a collective mothering. I often say, well, no, the patriarchy is over, not when women are paid the same amount as men, but when teenage boys want to become mothers, when everybody wants to be a mother. I mean, I'm fascinated by medieval iconography, pre-printing press iconography. And when I was traveling through France a few years ago, I noticed that in all these old churches, the Madonna is often flanked by two figures. One is Saint Joan of Arc, who I love. And there's Joan in her full armor with her sword, tough as nails, right? Ready for a fight. And then on the other side of the Madonna is Saint Anthony. And he's in his monk's robes, his beautiful soft dress, cradling the baby Jesus. There are a lot of different ideas about gender out there and about who can do mothering and what mothering looks like, right? And we've forgotten them. And no one gets enough mothering in our culture. Nobody. So what do we do about the fact that we don't get enough mothering and we're all addicted to something? You know, we are the culture of addiction, right? And, you know, my husband and I write about this book. We're really interested in, we're addicted to civilization. How do we cure our addiction to civilization? And we got very fascinated by 12-step work. But I finally have decided that the only sobriety from civilization is the long story of our souls. The realization that there's enough time and enough mothers, that in the long story of our souls, we have so many mothers on the other side, ancient mothers. You don't just have one mother. And, you know I actively call upon my children's mothers from other lives to protect and help them. I will always do so. And I actively call on my own mothers, whose names are mysterious to me, to protect me. And I call in my mothers before patriarchy to empower me, and my grandmothers before them, you know, make me even wilder than I already am. So we can, you know, there's a lot of talk about ancestral trauma these days, right? And unfortunately, a lot of what I've seen that work do is it kind of reifies the sense of exhaustion and the to-do list. Oh my God, not only do I have to heal myself, now I have to heal my ancestors. I don't want to do it. Well, I have good news for you. Your ancestors are dead. They don't need healing. They're fine. But we do need healing. And all of our ancestors on the other side are our mothers. And they are ready to take care of us and nourish us and love us and guide us. And we can do that work actively by asking for their help. We teach babies to cry it out, right? I'm going to tell you to cry and see what mothers start to show up and take care of you.
I would love to talk a little bit about the mother, Mary, and also Mary Magdalene, who show up both frequently in your book. And can you speak a little bit about these figures and their importance in your spirituality, especially as someone who is not Catholic? Like, I'm not Catholic, but I have an altar to them both in my home. So
I'm not even Christian. Okay. So I think it's important to say that.
Yes. Same.
And I have a real aversion to what I call the Valium virgins, you know, and they're actually post-industrial visions of the Madonna. You see, after about 1860, these images of Mary all in white and pastel, her eyes downcast, looking kind of simpering. These are industrial visions. If you look at medieval Madonnas, they're frequently bare-breasted. Sometimes they're expressing milk out of their breasts into the mouths of the faithful. And they frequently look you right in the eye. If you live in Brooklyn, you've been to the cloisters?
Yeah.
You walk into the Hall of Marys at the cloisters. And this is a powerful place. And speaking of power spots, I have a, Susan Weed says, the spot the cloisters is built above is one of the most powerful spots in all of Manhattan.
Fairies, right?
Yeah. And so those Madonnas look you in the eye. They're tough girls. They are working mamas. And I'm also fascinated by Paleolithic goddess figurines. I mean, so just, I have a devotion to the mothers by any name you want to call them. Mm. And that's, you know, my husband and I founded this radical feral fellowship, the Way of the Rose. And it, one of its principles is, you know, we're dedicated to the lady by any name you want to call her and to the earth. And, but one of the things I often say is the opposite of God is not goddess. It's everything. It's everything. It's this, the opposite of a homogenizing singularity is not another homogenous singularity. It's everything. What does it mean to experience the trees as our mother? People used to experience the trees as our mother. People still see the Madonna in the trees. Go out today, people listening. Find the Madonna in a tree and talk to her. Find a Madonna in a piece of toast. She's there. She's waiting for you to eat her. Just like the man waiting to eat his elephant. Find her in a stone, because you can find her in a stone. And my whole book is about finding the Madonna in the stone. And this was an ancient experience, was people to find the Madonna in a stone before they found her visual image. Find her in a cloud. Find her in a plant. Find her everywhere. See her everywhere. So I am devoted to the mothers. You know, if you go back in any culture, the Kogi culture, you know, the Kogi people, they're one of these last indigenous people in Colombia. They have a tradition of nine mothers. Ancient Icelandic culture, the tradition of the nine mothers. Ancient Greece, the nine muses, the nine manifestations of Durga. Every culture you go to, you don't get one mother. You get many mothers. At the foot of the cross is not one Mary, but three Marys, maiden, mother, and crone. Mary, Mary, and Mary. What do mothers know? You always want more mothers in the room. You don't want one mother. You want more mothers than you know what to do with. If everyone could be a mother, we might finally have enough mothers. So I am I devoted to Miriam? I am. In terms of Mary Magdalene, and you know, my daughter has written a book called The Madonna Secret. And, you know, for me, this is a work of genius. I've lived with her in the writing of this book for 10 years. And Mary Magdalene is who we call Mother Mary. Mary Magdalene is the Madonna in that book. And people knew this in the Middle Ages, that you didn't, many people in the Middle Ages, were coming out of the Mediterranean mystery cults. And one of the Mediterranean mystery cults is the mysteries of Dionysus and Ariadne. And in fact, the mysteries of the Rosary, which I write about a lot, are based on the Eleusinian mysteries of Dionysus. They're not based on the Gospels. They're based on Dionysus. And in those, Dionysus and Ariadne are Lord and Lady, God and Goddess, right? They are that divine, erotic, tantric union of sun and water that creates life on earth. So, you know, I will sometimes say, I pray to the sun, the seeds, the soil and the sea, you know, I pray to this erotic. I do want to pray to that erotic energy. You know, I love from tantric Buddhism, the image of the god and goddess in congress together. In the final mystery of the Rosary, is the coronation of Our Lady as Queen of Heaven and Earth. But that's not in the Gospels or the Bible. That comes from Dionysus. Mm. And he turns his body into a throne for Ariadne. You know, she's on the beach mourning stupid Theseus who's, you know, abandoned her. And Dionysus shows up to her and he says, why are you crying for a man when you could have a god? Goddess, you need a god. And so he takes her onto his lap. And he says, come, my queen, I will crown you with stars and make you queen of heaven and earth.
We love that story on this podcast. Kristen has to maybe share at some point with you. She rewrote that tale in like this stunning, like first person narrative. Like it's incredible. Sorry, Kristen, I got to gas you up on that. But
thank you.
Of course. Yeah, of course. It's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah. And Ariadne's been everywhere this fall. I feel like just keeps coming up, like the sort of weaving through.
In the labyrinth, yeah.
Dionysus, the Thyrsus, the Maenads, like all of it.
Well, a lot of the Maenads are like those hysterical women we are taught to fear, right? Like they're like supposed to be the hysterical girls in the Crucible. And the Maenads are animals. They're women who've remembered their animals. And, you know, as my daughter has written about beautifully, it wasn't so good being a Greek woman. You were under lock and key. You were a slave. So Dionysus is freeing these enslaved women. And the men are getting angry about it and saying they're crazy. Well, we've heard that story before.
Pine-tipped wands for all of us.
Kristen, would you please send me your story? I'd love that.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Kate and I do a seasonal program called The Crossroads, and we did Ariadne and Dionysus this last time, and it was really, really special. I've been wanting to visit that story and reimagine it for a while. So yeah, I'd love to share. Perdita, the Tamed Wild Coven and community loves books and book recommendations. And I know we were chatting before we started recording about book recs for just a moment. And I'm curious if there's anything you're reading right now and love and would like to share, or perhaps a favorite book about magic or mystery or communicating with the unseen.
I'm an omnivorous reader. So, and I love all kinds of books, but I would love to offer some options on what I call the long story of our souls. And we don't have enough books about the long story. We've lived trapped inside the short story for so long, where we feel like we only have one life to get it right. So I'm fascinated by books that explore the long story. And I think one of the greatest books I've ever read about this, is a book by a writer, an English writer called Kate Atkinson, called Life After Life. And it is one of the most obvious and generous and strange and compelling. You know, Kate Atkinson is a popular writer. She writes murder mysteries. So she's a really, you know what I mean? Like she's not gonna, it's not a hard read, but it's a thoroughly fascinating book about one life lived a million different ways. And it makes you think about your own long story in a totally new way. And then the kind of balance of that book is the nonfiction book that I'm recommending that a lot of people don't know about. And this is a much less accessible, but I find very rewarding book. It's called Otherlands by Thomas Halliday. He's a British writer. And it's really a look at deep time on this planet. And one of the things Halliday says in this book, which I find so beautiful, is that nature is not nostalgic. Nature is not trying to do some conservation project where it gets it back to the way it used to be. It's always creating some new creative efflorescence. And so it really redefines what it would mean in a moment of climate crisis to join in the creative collaborations with this planet. So it's really it's a real game changer about our thoughts about interacting with the natural world. I often say that, you know, not only do I believe in a woman's right to choose what to make would do with her body, I believe in the earth's right to choose what to do with her body. And that's really hard for people to understand, that she's making choices from a very different perspective about her body than we as very limited human beings can often understand. And so it's a very humbling, but oddly hopeful, beautiful book. It also, even though he's a scientist, it seems to be utterly psychically channeled. So those are two books I love. I have so many books I love. I love books about magic, of course. I mean, we could probably do nothing but talks about books about magic.
It's true.
Next
episode.
These sound
so beautiful. Yeah, next time, part two. And I know we're running short on time here, so would you mind telling listeners where they can find your work and if there's anything upcoming that you are particularly excited about right now?
Well, I offer a lot of different workshops on how to do this work. And I try to offer lots of different entry points. I don't ever create kind of a hierarchical program that people have to do. What I want to do is create lots and lots of different opportunities for shifting our belief sphere. So if you go to takebackthemagic.com, which is my website, you'll find all of my offerings for 2024. And I'm doing a lot of different programs and workshops, from year-long adventures to weekend experiences to, you know, what catches your eye. And I also have a Substack, Take Back the Magic. And that has a free Substack, and I do a lot of writing on that. And I also have a paid version where I share with the current books I'm working on. But my paid Substack includes this monthly conversation, a Zoom invite to a talk conversation about the unseen world. And that's very financially accessible for people. So I want to make it possible to come and read my work and have that conversation. I'm on Facebook and I'm on Instagram and I'm around, and I love to talk about the dead with people, and I love to hear their stories. And I can't stop myself. I have to write back and I have to hear more and ask questions. And every time someone tells one of these stories about their encounters with the other side, I think it empowers everyone to begin to tell their story.
Mm-hmm. And Perdita, before we go, do you have any parting pieces of wisdom to offer our listeners?
None of this that I've said today is a tentative belief. No one has to believe anything. But you can experience the reality of this for yourself. And the way to do that is very simply start slow and small and stay low to the ground. But ask someone on the other side for something real that you need. You know, I was on a radio show with someone a few weeks ago, and I said this to him. And so he decided to ask his parents, because he wanted to do his radio show full time. And 2 days after he asked his parents, the network called him up and said, "We want to start adding ads to your show so that we can begin to pay you. You don't have to believe me. Try it out. Ask for help. See what happens."
Thank you so much for joining us today, Perdita and listeners, on Magic and Alchemy, a podcast by Tamed Wild. Again, we're Kate Ballou and Kristen Lisenby. You can find us online at K8Ballou and at East and Alchemy. Send us all of your questions, comments, or just say hello via email at podcast@tamedwild.com. And you can view all the amazing offerings from Tamed Wild on their Instagram at tamedwild or on the blog tamedwild.com.
Join us back here in 2 weeks for another magical conversation. Just a reminder that magic and alchemy are always available to those who know where to look for it. So mote it be, or something better. Until next time.